Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the 12th episode of The Fall of Rome. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. When we think of the Roman Empire, there are a few different things that come to mind. We might think about gladiators, always a fun topic in pop culture. We might think about the army, of disciplined legions marching in lockstep to fight some barbarian foe. The most enduring and obvious legacy of the Roman Empire is its buildings, huge structures like the Colosseum, embedded within the landscape of enormous cities that held hundreds of thousands of people. It was the Roman economy that enabled all of this, from amphitheaters and aqueducts to highly skilled gladiators fighting for the entertainment of mass urban audiences. The surpluses the Roman economy produced allowed for the concentration of people in cities in numbers and proportions that wouldn't be matched again until the modern period, for the construction of thousands of monumental buildings that endure to this day, and for the support of a standing army of hundreds of thousands of professional soldiers along a frontier that stretched from Britain to the Sahara. The Roman economy was an agrarian one, focused around agricultural production, but that doesn't mean that it was primitive. It was quite complex, and despite its basis in agriculture, it had well-developed commercial markets that operated on a trans-regional scale. The Roman state provided the infrastructure and stability that lowered costs to the point where huge amounts of bulk goods, the agricultural products the economy specialized in producing, could move easily and cheaply, even over long distances. North African pottery sat on farmers' tables in Britain and Italy. Egyptian grain turned into bread in Constantinople, and Spanish olive oil supplied Rome. The 4th century was a time of growth across most of the Roman Empire, but by the end of the century, large chunks of territory had begun to disconnect from the economic system that underpinned it. 100 years later, it would be confined to some parts of the Mediterranean. A century after that, around the year 600, only the most important Mediterranean ports would still have some connection to a broader trans-regional economy. Today's episode is about how and why the Roman economy fell apart. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. Let's step back for a moment and revisit some of what we talked about in the last episode about what made the Roman economy distinctive. It was agrarian, which it had in common with basically every pre-modern economy, but it also had some features that set it apart. First, it was fully monetized. That doesn't just mean that people used money, though that's obviously important because it enabled the existence of markets, but that people could think of goods, services, and labor in abstract, monetary terms. Second, it was in meaningful ways a market economy, or at the very least, an economy that had a whole bunch of price-setting markets across regions that bore some relationship to each other. Goods and people moved in huge quantities from place to place, not just in the Mediterranean, but also beyond. Now, this issue of markets is a matter of real debate among specialists, and as I mentioned last time, I tend to come down on the side of that argument that emphasizes the more modern aspects of the Roman economy. I want to put all my cards on the table so you know where I'm coming from, and you can feel free to agree or disagree. Third, the Roman state enabled all of this movement through its enormous investments in infrastructure, roads, bridges, canals, and above all, ports. In economic terms, these things lowered the transaction costs that might otherwise have made the large-scale movement of goods and people prohibitively expensive. The state also created a baseline level of demand for particular commodities, especially subsidized grain and oil for the cities of Rome and Constantinople, that had huge ramifications for the broader economy. We'll talk a lot about that in today's episode. There are a whole bunch of other things that we could talk about here, including urbanism, chattel slavery, and the economic rationalism I discussed at length in the last episode, but I'd say these are the three biggest things. The story I'll be telling in today's episode is about how they fell apart, and we're going to be following the lives of two people, a woman living in a British market town around the end of the 4th century, and a merchant operating out of Rome in the second half of the 5th century in order to ground these changes in the lives of real people. Now, I want to be very clear here about the argument that I'm making. These changes to the economy were generally slow and even imperceptible, rather than quick and catastrophic, though, as we'll see, this varied from place to place. At no point, even at its low ebb in the late 7th and early 8th centuries, did the long-distance movement of goods and people ever completely stop. What changed, again, generally at a slow and leisurely pace, was the scale. Instead of huge quantities of bulk goods like pottery and common agricultural products like olive oil and grain, only small quantities of extremely valuable luxury goods came to move any real distance beyond the biggest ports of the Mediterranean. The genuine price-setting markets that had once dictated the price of goods disappeared, and these luxury items were valued more for the prestige and status they gave to the owner rather than being a part of daily life. Instead of large numbers of people of many different social groups moving from place to place, travel was much more restricted to the elite and to religious pilgrims. Fewer places were included in these networks of long-distance exchange. In 350, you could find imported North African pottery in British market towns thousands of miles from where it was made, but in 600, only the biggest Mediterranean ports still had that pottery. In essence, the networks of trade and movement that had once reached even humble, out-of-the-way places in marginal provinces contracted, and contracted some more, and then contracted even further until there were only a few places in the Mediterranean that touched the wider world in any meaningful way. In my view, this is what made the Roman economy special. This is what more broadly defined the Roman world as a whole. It was the sum total of this dense web of connections that bound together so many different places in so many different ways. That's the precise argument that I'm making here, that what changed was the scale and the reach of those connections. So let's start by trying to wrap our heads around the role of the Roman state in all of this. To put my cards on the table here, I'm following the broad outlines of the argument presented by an outstanding scholar named Chris Wickham in a book called Framing the Early Middle Ages. If you want a deep dive into this topic, and I do mean deep because the book's about 1,000 pages long, I highly recommend it. Now, a few scholars have critiqued and sharpened Wickham's points in the 10 years since it came out, but the basic form hasn't been challenged. One recent book described its findings as commanding, quote, near universal assent, and I, like the rest, find it pretty convincing. Wickham's argument about the state goes like this, quote, the late Roman Empire was territorially unified by its tax system, simply because so many goods were moved from place to place by the state to supply the three main expenses of Roman government, the army, the cities of Rome and Constantinople, which were supplied by the state for symbolic purposes, and the civil administration, end quote. That's a simple enough point, but the implications of it are enormous for understanding the economy of the late Roman Empire and why it fell apart. In the last episode, I emphasized the role of markets and commercial exchange, focusing on the more private aspects of the economy. This week, a lot of what we'll be talking about has to do with the state. It's not just that the state created the conditions that allowed private enterprise to flourish. It also, on its own account, moved tremendous amounts of goods and huge numbers of people around the Mediterranean and beyond. Now, this isn't the same thing as saying that the Roman Empire had a state-directed economy in the sense of the Cold War-era Eastern Bloc, but that the state did play a substantial role in the overall level of economic activity that took place in the late Roman world. In the words of the economic historian Nicholas Oikonomides, the Roman economy represented, quote, a curious mixture of free enterprise and state intervention. When we say taxes, what precisely do we mean here? We're not just talking about money, although the state did collect some portion of its taxes in cash and in increasing proportion over the course of the 4th century. In places where the state had no need for taxes in kind, its demand for money indirectly forced people into commercial markets, since they had to sell their goods in order to come up with cash to pay the tax collectors. Now, as I mentioned, we're also talking about taxes in kind, meaning goods, which the state collected directly in that form. This was one of Diocletian's innovations at the end of the 3rd century crisis, something we touched on in the episode about the army. Simply put, the state needed to feed and supply those who worked for it, primarily the army, but also the civil service and the vast numbers of others who operated on its behalf, like the folks who maintained the way stations of the public post. It needed grain for bread and porridge, it needed livestock for meat, and it needed wool for clothing, among many, many, many other things. If the state needed a material, any material, from olive oil to iron ore, it could requisition it as tax and direct it where it needed to go. Even if the state were collecting taxes in kind, though, there was still a monetary aspect to all this. Whatever Diocletian had first intended with his system of taxation in kind, and there's some debate about this, tax collectors soon came to reckon the value of the goods they were collecting in monetary terms. In effect, the state was forcing those being taxed to sell it wool, grain, olive oil, or what have you at a particular rate. Now, there's obviously the potential for real abuse in this system if the state's buyers can just set the rate of sale. For example, if the army decides it needs all of your cattle and not just a couple of them, there's theoretically nothing stopping that supply officer from saying the sum value of your cattle is precisely the tax that you owe. With that said, though, the price at which those goods were being purchased wasn't wholly arbitrary. That's what our evidence tells us, that it did bear some real relationship to actual market prices for those goods. This is hard evidence of the extent to which the later Roman economy was monetized and based on markets. Even when forcibly purchasing goods, the concept of their value was a monetary one connected to broader price-setting markets. This meant that the state could also just collect taxes and money too, since it was operating with that standard of value in mind anyway. This process was called coemptio, and it was essential to the functioning of the late Roman economy. The sheer scale of this activity is hard to overstate, since it operated at local, regional, and trans-Mediterranean levels. At the lowest level, the local, consider the local way station for the public post system, the cursus publicus. Now, these way stations kept horses for the use of state couriers and other official travelers, and gave them a place to stay and rest as they traveled along the roads of the Roman Empire. These way stations could be in the most remote areas, like the Meseta of central Spain or the highlands of Anatolia. The local shepherds or farmers might pay their tax obligations by supplying the stable hands and other workers at the local way stations with whatever they needed. That's the local level. At the regional level, think about the army. As we talked about in the episode on the topic, some of the army's supply needs could be met locally. Along the Rhine frontier, for example, it's clear that local economies, things like horse breeding operations, grain cultivation, and so on, were geared toward producing for the army. With hundreds of thousands of troops stationed along the frontiers, though, there was no way that local producers could meet all that demand. That meant that the army needed to source its supplies from a broader region. At the northern end of the Rhine frontier, to name just one example, that meant drawing grain, meat, and other necessities from all over northern Gaul and even Britain. This sort of thing happened all over the empire, from Syria to the Danube to the Rhine to northern Britain. Wherever there was a frontier, and therefore an army, the Roman state had to gear an entire regional economy toward producing and transporting the supplies necessary to keep that army going. Finally, there was the trans-regional level of state taxation and movement of goods, and this applies mostly to the Mediterranean portion of the empire. Mostly, this means the annona civica, something that we've touched on briefly in previous episodes, but that I want to fully explore here. The annona civica was the state-provided supply of grain that went to the public in Rome and Constantinople, and in Rome it also included olive oil and, at some points, pork. Think about how much grain it took to supply a city with hundreds of thousands of inhabitants. This was enough demand to retool the agrarian economy of an entire region or regions. Tens of thousands of people, if not more, were directly involved in producing and transporting all of this from its point of origin to Rome and Constantinople. The annona created two tax spines, one in the eastern Mediterranean and one in the western Mediterranean. In the east, it bound together Egypt and Constantinople. In the west, it tied North Africa and to a lesser extent Sicily to Rome. Its broad outlines worked like this. The state collected tax in kind through the coemptio system that I mentioned a little while ago, which was then transported by state agents along roads built and maintained at state expense to ports that were maintained at state expense. There, the grain and oil was loaded onto ships that were subsidized by the state through tax exemptions in return for transporting the annona promptly and meeting certain conditions. A law of the year 396, for example, stipulates that the naviculari, ship owners, had to be back in their point of origin no more than 2 years after first setting out. What this means is that these shippers were obligated just to load and deliver the anona. Once they'd done so, they were free to transport whatever goods they pleased to whatever ports commercial logic dictated that they go to, with their transport costs already mostly or entirely covered by the tax breaks they received. As we discussed in the episode on North Africa, episode 8, this is what explains the presence of huge amounts of African pottery and amphorae in ports all over the Western Mediterranean. These state-subsidized ships might have been carrying grain or oil for the anona, but they had plenty of room left over to carry crates of African red-slip pottery or extra oil and grain for commercial sale. Now, we shouldn't see this state-sponsored activity as a detriment to private commerce or somehow mutually exclusive with it. Instead, the state's involvement reinforced and enabled private exchange at all three levels that we discussed, the local, the regional, and the transregional. The state's demand for these products and tax stimulated an economy of scale, where estate owners or lessees could simply produce more grain or oil than was necessary to meet tax obligations and sell the excess on the commercial market. The presses were already built. The kilns to make amphorae were already built. The infrastructure to move it was already in place. The money the state minted allowed for cash transactions, and its cash payments to government officials, permanent and temporary employees, and of course soldiers, provided a mechanism for moving that cash into the economy more broadly. In that sense, the institutions and activities of the state acted as a pump for the monetary economy, flooding marginal provinces like Britain and the north of Gaul with currency it otherwise wouldn't have received in the course of normal commercial activities. Places like inland Spain and the mountainous interior of Anatolia were likewise dependent on the traffic state activities brought through their regions. Now, of course, there's also the matter of infrastructure, something that we've touched on a few times now. No state until the modern period built infrastructure on the scale or of the quality that the Roman Empire did. Whenever a new province came under Roman control, roads immediately followed afterward. Why? It wasn't just about the practicalities of moving soldiers or supplies around, though they obviously allowed for that. Roads were also a manifestation of the sheer power of the state, physical evidence of the power Rome had to dramatically rewrite the landscape of the territory it controlled. The state built and maintained these roads, which allowed for the easy movement of goods overland in a way that was never possible on such a scale beforehand. Overland travel was much harder and more expensive than travel by sea or by river, though not as much as some modern historians have made it out to be. The state was involved in enabling traffic by ship, too. It built and maintained canals and ports, and as we've discussed, it subsidized some forms of shipping. On a less obvious note, the state's enforcement of laws and regulations helped to create an environment where it could be certain that commercial contracts were upheld. Trust and personal connections were always important in trade, but so too is a legal environment that supports and enables commercial activity. So, to sum up, the state indirectly provided the context that allowed for commercial activity. It directly stimulated whole sectors of the economy, moving huge quantities of goods and people around for its own purposes. It minted coinage and guaranteed its value, and the mechanisms of state activity ensured that coinage would circulate throughout the entire empire, not just where unfettered commercial markets would make it run. As the Roman state gradually fell apart, so too did the economy it enabled.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As the Roman state fell to pieces, the economy it had helped to drive did so as well, but the correlation wasn't necessarily direct or immediate. It's not like as soon as there were no longer Roman tax collectors or bureaucrats, people stopped growing olives and pressing them, stopped growing grain, stopped firing amphorae, and stopped taking those goods to markets and selling them. Roads, bridges, and ports maintained at state expense didn't deteriorate and become unusable overnight when the Vandals took North Africa and snapped the tax spine that had driven commerce in the Western Mediterranean. Different parts of the Roman world experienced the end of the Roman economy in very different ways, and the current trend in scholarship is to emphasize just how long it took for a recognizably Roman economy to disappear completely. In the Eastern Mediterranean, you can make a strong argument that things didn't really change at all in most places until the middle of the 7th century, and in Egypt, there wasn't even a meaningful disruption of economic life even after the Islamic conquest. In the West, the faintest traces of the once dense exchange networks that crisscrossed the Mediterranean hung on in the big ports until around 700, more than 250 years after the Vandals took Carthage. Cities like Marseille, Tarragona, and Carthage all shrank, and the scale of their involvement in a gradually contracting Mediterranean scaled back, but it was still happening there. For these places, the ones that had been the most prominent and the most tied into the trans-regional level that we talked about earlier, the shift away from the Roman economy and toward what came after was long and gentle. That wasn't the case everywhere, though. Some parts of the empire were much more dependent on the state as an economic driver than others, and when the state effectively ceased to exist in those places, it was only a short while before the economy that had been built on top of the state also ceased to exist. It's hard to conceptualize the shifts in these particular places, especially Britain and Northern Gaul, as anything other than a catastrophe. So let's dig into catastrophe first. Why exactly was the end of the Roman state such a crushing blow in these provinces? We'll focus on Roman Britain, and more specifically a single person in Roman Britain, to try to wrap our heads around these changes. Now, there were a couple of million people, to take a low-end estimate, living in Roman Britain in the middle of the 4th century. In every meaningful way, it was a Roman province, and lowland Britain in particular was as Roman as anywhere else in the empire. People spoke Latin, not just in the big cities, but even in the countryside. They drank some imported wine from Gaul and ate off North African pottery. They used Roman coins to buy things through commercial markets and pay their taxes to the state. The Roman army garrisoned Hadrian's Wall in the north, and a profusion of forts along the east and to a lesser extent west coasts. Villas that wouldn't have been out of place in the countryside of Italy or Spain dotted the countryside, home to aristocrats who delighted in the high literary and oratorical culture common to elites across the empire. Cities like London served as points of cosmopolitan contact with the wider economic world of the empire, the point of arrival for a wide array of goods and people. The most characteristic thing about late Roman Britain were the market towns of a few thousand people which, unlike the towns and the cities of the earlier period, grew up organically rather than having been planted by the state for the state's purposes. Between 70 and 80 of these market towns have been found all over the region, from Catterick in the north to Worcester to Needham in the south, usually at or near the junctions of roads and rivers. Now, these weren't huge cities that held tens of thousands of people. They weren't centers of governance, though maybe the state had a small presence in some. And they weren't full of rich aristocrats who built huge, tastefully decorated townhouses as an escape from their country villas. These towns weren't even particularly well connected into the trans-regional Roman economy. These weren't the places you'd go to get wholesale North African pottery, for example. You could probably find a few items of wider provenance available for sale there. Now, what's striking about these places is precisely the fact that they're local, the central points of surprisingly complex and sophisticated local economies. They were prosperous working settlements, places that produced artisanal goods like metalwork, pottery, and leather, among many other things, that serviced the rural economies of small regions. They existed to service the small farms and the great estates of the countryside, providing them with the goods and services they needed to function. These were the places that these farmers and estate managers came to buy what they needed and to sell their excess produce. While they were fundamentally local, market towns like this could only have existed in Britain in the context of the broader Roman economy. Money, and a monetary economy more generally, was what made them function. Farmers and estate managers sold agricultural produce for cash, which they exchanged for the kinds of necessary items the local artisans produced in the town. Now, that produce moved from there along the roads that the Roman state had built, to the market towns, and from there to the larger urban centers. In other words, these places were the nodes in the economic network that linked local economies to regional and then to trans-regional economies. 80 years later, by 430 or so, all of this was gone completely. So let's introduce the character we'll follow through this transformation. We'll call her Antonia, and say she was born around the high point of these market towns, around 350. We'll place her in a town that's been extensively excavated, Dorchester-on-Thames, about 10 miles southeast of Oxford and 55 miles west of London. It's located right next to the confluence of the River Thames and the Thames, and also had a fine Roman road running close to it that connected to the fort at Alchester, some 16 miles north of the settlement. Dorchester therefore had easy access to broader economic networks, since it was just an easy journey downriver to London. When Antonia was born around 350, Dorchester was a thriving town of perhaps a couple of thousand inhabitants. It wasn't grand, but it was prosperous, with a low wall and ditches surrounding the populated area and large cemeteries outside them. A major road ran through the town on a roughly north-south axis, and a number of smaller streets ran perpendicular to it. In the center of town, there was an open gravel space that held regular markets, and it rang with the sounds of trade and commerce, with farmers in from the country selling their wares and picking up a new plow or a clay jug or two. All of these streets were fronted by buildings constructed from timber and thatch that faced outwards, with shutters that could be opened or closed depending on the time of day. The front was the commercial section of the building, and living quarters sat at the back, facing away from the street and towards small cobbled yards, gardens, or perhaps animal pens. This was the kind of building in which Antonia was born and grew up. Her family were potters, and Dorchester-on-Thames was known as a local center of pottery production. There were fancy, imported North African wares, of course, that were ubiquitous all across the western half of the empire. For day-to-day use in the countryside, though, most people had locally or at most regionally made wares. Dorchester-on-Thames was a center of regional production. Now, these were still patterned after styles that were popular throughout the empire, showing just how broad tastes had become even in the countryside that Antonia's family produced for. For example, the stamp-decorated pots that Antonia's family made were similar to ones made at the same time in Tunisia and even the Eastern Mediterranean. Antonia's youth fit neatly into the prosperity of Dorchester-on-Thames. There was a small contingent of soldiers located in the town, and a minor administrative presence. This was where the local farmers and estate managers came to pay their taxes, either in cash or in kind, which in the latter case would be used to supply the town's soldiers, or shipped onward to one of the coastal forts. The soldiers were paid in cash, and that money was spent directly into the local economy. When she was in her late teens, Antonia married the son of another family of potters, and they moved into their own timber, thatched-roofed house that opened onto the same street as that of her parents. Both Antonia and her husband worked to produce this fine stamped pottery, which they sold either out of the shop or at a temporary stall in the open gravel market area in the center of town. They did good business for the first 10 years or so of their marriage, and had two children who survived infancy into childhood. Word trickled into Dorchester about barbarian raiders, Scots from the west and Picts from the north, along with the occasional band of Saxons along the east coast. There had been a major incursion around the time Antonia and her husband got married, and small war bands of Picts had gotten as far as the countryside and the neighboring regions, but none of that ever really touched them in their little market town. Besides, they had walls and a few soldiers to defend them. Life went on. Things were starting to change, though. By 385, when Antonia was around 35 years old, it was getting harder to sell their pottery. There was less money around, it seemed, and more trading in the town market was being done as barter rather than in cash. A few years before, the general Magnus Maximus had declared himself emperor in Britain and taken his army with him to Gaul. He'd taxed Britain heavily to pay for this. Antonia and her neighbors resented the higher taxes, of course, but they didn't make the connection between pay for the army and the shortage of coin. With far fewer soldiers in Britain overall, there was less coinage coming in to pay them, and less coin coming into Britain meant less coin in circulation in general. The villas in the countryside around Dorchester were beginning to fail. One burned down, and the owner couldn't afford to repair it. Another simply went out of business, with the tenants abandoning the main house and farming just to support themselves and their families, rather than for a market that no longer had the cash to pay them for their produce. In Dorchester itself, the modest little suburbs outside the town walls were abandoned, so there simply wasn't enough day-to-day labor to support the people who'd lived there. The town's iron workers were having trouble getting enough raw ore to make new objects, and there was less demand anyway from the countryside. Antonia knew that Dorchester was still doing better than some other towns, which were being abandoned completely. At least Dorchester still had a few soldiers and some administration, which meant that modest amounts of coin were still, every once in a while, coming into the community. Still, there were fewer and fewer people around for Antonia and her husband to sell her pottery to, and the industry as a whole was declining sharply. More and more people were leaving Dorchester for the countryside or even leaving Britain entirely. People were having fewer children. Now by 400, there was almost no coin left at all. The soldiers had left Dorchester, and the town was crumbling around Antonia and her husband. There was no money for repairs to anything. Their children had both left as well. Their son had traveled north to Hadrian's Wall to join what was left of the army, and they hadn't heard from him in some time. Their daughter had married a farmer who lived in the countryside a few miles outside of town. There was nobody left to sell pottery to and nothing to buy it with, so they grew vegetables in the garden behind their house and raised livestock in what had once been a neighbor's shop. When they needed something, they bartered for it. Still, Dorchester was their home. Antonia and her husband stuck it out for as long as they could, surrounded by the few neighbors who remained, people they'd known for their entire lives. They tried to keep the public spaces of the town clean and open, hoping that the merchants and the markets might still yet return. By 420, though, by the time Antonia was 70 years of age, there was nobody left in Dorchester. Antonia's husband had died, and she herself had moved out to a farmstead in the country to live with her daughter and her grandchildren. There was no coin left, no towns either. Pottery, the product Antonia's parents had made, and she had too for so many years, was gone as well. Nobody built in stone anymore. The prosperous Britain into which Antonia had been born was gone completely, shattered in just a single generation. The historian Robin Fleming, in her great book Britain After Rome, sums it up like this, quote, "Its, Britain's, prosperity was founded on the ability of a substantial part of the population to purchase and sell copious amounts of low-value goods, both agricultural and manufactured, and it could only do so if there was a dense network of small towns providing ready access to flourishing markets," end quote. Without the coinage that the army and the state pumped into Britain, the monetary economy disappeared. Without the monetary economy, you couldn't have market towns. Without market towns, there were no markets. And without markets, there was no more specialized economic activity, either of the agricultural kind that villas had performed in the countryside and manufacturers had, like Antonia, had done in the small towns. This was nothing short of an economic catastrophe. Everything Roman about the economy of Roman Britain disappeared in a relative blink of an eye when the financial pump of the state receded from the island. We can imagine how disorienting that would have been for people like Antonia, who were born into what seemed like a prosperous and stable world, but which fell apart when the state did as well.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
The end of the Roman state was disastrous for the economy in Britain and the northern part of Gaul. And though we haven't talked much about them in this show, also the inland areas of the Balkans and Spain, which likewise depended on the fiscal mechanisms of Roman governance. The big cities of the Mediterranean world experienced a much more gentle transition out of the characteristically Roman economy whose outlines we discussed in the last episode, though. Unlike Britain and northern Gaul, which depended on the state to pump raw cash into the economy and to provide demand for the agricultural products and goods these regions produced, the Mediterranean world had long been home to long-distance trading networks. These networks were robust enough, and demand was high enough, to support a market-driven movement of goods in the absence of the Roman state. That doesn't mean that things didn't change, though. The big thing here was the Vandal conquest of North Africa between 430 and 440, which broke the tax spine that provided grain and oil that supplied the massive population of the city of Rome. Remember, that tax spine also included the subsidies for ships operating out of Carthage, which also carried large amounts of other goods for strictly commercial sale rather than state taxation. Now, we might expect this to have been an immediate disaster, especially after the Vandals took Carthage in 439, but that's not really how it turned out. Instead, the Annona system had allowed African producers to get a huge leg up on their competitors elsewhere, and they stayed prosperous, maybe even got more prosperous, when they no longer had to worry about satisfying the demands of the Roman state. North African exports actually expanded throughout the Mediterranean world after that. Now, other places were less fortunate, but still prosperous throughout the 5th and into the 6th centuries. Cities like Marseille and Tarragona, Rome and Carthage, Naples and Narbonne all remained little islands of concentrated commercial demand that could sustain something that was still recognizably like the trade that had characterized the Roman economy. As I mentioned earlier, historians are inclined to see what happened in the Mediterranean as a long, drawn-out, and gentle contraction rather than a catastrophic shift. I want to push back against this just a little bit, though. While I agree that there wasn't a catastrophic drop-off in the Mediterranean economy, it was still a contraction, and emphasizing the timescale of it to show what a long process this drop-off was doesn't change the fact that it was indeed a drop-off. As time went on, fewer and fewer places remained involved in these long-distance networks of exchange and movement. More and more places became isolated, involved only in local or at most regional networks. This, to me, was one of the defining characteristics of the Roman economy. You're always going to have big port cities that are connected to the wider world, but what was special about the Roman economy was how even smaller, more modest places were nevertheless connected to regional or trans-regional patterns of trade. So what if you could still get fine African pottery in Rome in 550? It was Rome. You'd expect to get imported pottery in Rome, which was still one of the biggest cities in the Mediterranean world. What had been remarkable about the Roman economy was that you could have gotten that fine pottery at a small inland Italian town, not just in Rome. Now, with all that said, that doesn't make the experience of the people who were living in the cities that were still connected into the broader Mediterranean trade networks less compelling or less worth exploring. Let's try to think about this from the perspective of a merchant operating out of the city of Rome. We'll call him John, a common enough name, and say that he was born around 430. He came of age in a still monumentally impressive but shrinking city that carried a heavy sense of faded grandeur. Emperors were no longer resident in Rome and hadn't been in a very, very long time, but there were still a ton of wealthy beyond imagining aristocrats in the city. Abandoned buildings, though, were everywhere, and some residents had taken to gardening in the plots once occupied by multi-story apartment houses, wine shops, or artisanal manufacturing. But Rome was still one of the largest cities in the world, with at least a few hundred thousand souls living there, and potentially as many as 700,000 still living in the city. John's father had been a prosperous merchant who had a small government post on the side working on the Annona, ensuring that the grain dropped off by merchant ships at the port of Portus on the mouth of the Tiber made its way to the city for distribution. From the time he was a boy, John went to work with his father, making regular trips from the city down to Portus to haggle with merchants out of Arles or Marseille about wine, Sicilians about grain, and North Africans about oil or pottery. They'd engage the services of a trusted banker to pay coin to the shipper, then move the goods up the Tiber to Rome, where they either sold it to smaller distributors or sold the whole batch wholesale, likely to an agent of one of Rome's ultra-wealthy resident aristocrats. John was around 10 when the Vandals took Carthage and completed their conquest of North Africa. Since North Africa was the source for the grain that had fed Rome, this was a matter of serious concern. The Vandals weren't in any particular hurry to continue sending tens of thousands of tons of produce to Rome as taxes they weren't obligated to pay. Luckily for Rome, though, North Africa wasn't the only region that exported grain in copious quantities. Alongside the Annona, there had always existed a substantial commercial trade in foodstuffs. Calabria, Sicily, Spain, and even Egypt all shipped grain and other goods to Rome. With the collapse of the North African tax spine, these other regions, except for Egypt, were reoriented toward providing the Annona. As John grew into adulthood in the 440s, he and his father barely dealt in North African products, and the city maintained most of its population. But that changed when the Vandals sacked the city in 455, stripping it of much of its wealth and dragging off many hostages and captives to be sold as slaves. Almost immediately, the population of the city shrank as tens of thousands fled into the countryside, never to return. John didn't leave, though, and Rome remained a huge city with a massive population by any reasonable standard. His father died just after the Vandal sack, and John took over the family business, which he carried on much as he had before. The end of the conflict with the Vandals after that meant that North African goods were showing up again, and by the 460s, John was bringing boatloads of fine pottery and amphorae full of oil up the Tiber to Rome's docks for sale. He dealt in grain from Calabria and Sicily, and wine from Sicily, Campania, Gaul, and Spain, with enough sources shipping to the capital to create competition and real price-setting markets for those goods. While Rome continued to shrink over the course of the rest of John's life, with more and more public spaces being abandoned, there were still enough people living in the city for it to remain a major center of importation. By the time Romulus Augustulus was deposed in 476 and the Roman Empire in Italy formally ended, there were still around 150,000 or 200,000 people living in the city, fewer than a third of the number who had lived there at the time of John's birth, but still substantial. Many of those who remained were wealthy, though, and they were always interested in luxury goods. John still dealt in bulk goods like grain and oil, but fine varieties of Eastern wine from Gaza or the Aegean were growing more and more important to his business. By the time John died around the year 500, Rome was ruled by the Ostrogoths instead of an emperor. Its Senate was little more than a self-important body of idle aristocrats with more money and time than good sense. The city had shrunk to 100 or 150,000 people. The inhabitants of Rome were busily stripping away marble from dilapidated monuments to build their homes. But despite all those changes, John's role really hadn't changed that much over the course of his life. He was importing roughly the same goods, oil, grain, wine, pottery, from roughly the same places, North Africa, Sicily, Spain, Gaul, and the rest of Italy. What had really changed was the scale of that business. There were far fewer merchants making their way from Rome down to Portus to meet the ships, and the market they served was far smaller. The Annona was for all intents and purposes gone, though officials still did their best to make sure the city was fed. It must have been a somewhat eerie feeling, living among the ruins of a mostly deserted city, heading down the Tiber to a port that within living memory had been full and bustling every day. Rome's drop-off was far more dramatic than that of most major port cities in the Western Mediterranean, simply because it had been far more heavily subsidized by the Roman state than most. And when the state disappeared, so too did much of Rome's prosperity and its population. The broad outlines of the shift that John and his fellow merchants in Rome were experiencing are applicable everywhere, though. Slowly shrinking populations, and therefore markets, with a gradually contracting scale of business, even as the basic networks of exchange remained roughly the same. Coinage and the monetary economy never left Rome, even at its lowest point, and it remained deeply connected to the outside world. The Roman Empire provided the conditions for unparalleled economic complexity and regional integration, powering a monetary economy that moved huge amounts of goods and people across the greatest infrastructure the world had ever seen, or would see for centuries to come. Our friends Antonia and John experienced the end of the Roman economy much differently, with the economic life of Antonia's small market town collapsing entirely, and that of Rome contracting gradually, if still dramatically, over the course of their lifetimes. Different areas experienced the end of the Roman economy in drastically different ways. There's no one-size-fits-all narrative that covers everywhere equally. Some places depended far more, both directly and indirectly, on the Roman state than others. In the Mediterranean, large-scale exchange networks could survive the end of the state, even expand the reach of places like North Africa, but even these systems of trade still declined over time until they too finally disappeared. Places like Marseille were barely clinging on to the last tatters of a once dominant economic system at the end of the 7th century, and it would be another 100 years before the motor of Mediterranean trade would start up again. Next time, we'll bring together the economy with the broader topics of communication and mobility to talk about how the Roman world as a whole fell apart. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd really appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line. If you want to really help me out, you can take the survey at wondery.com/survey. That's wondery.com/survey. If you're looking for more history podcasts, check out History Matters on iTunes and SoundCloud. A historian friend of mine and I, Keith Plimers, are talking about present-day issues and historical perspective, tackling topics like political breakdown, settlement patterns, globalization, and much, much more. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.
Jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.